So, where are we?
We started at the
beginning. Right. So we also discussed that there are two types of atoms.
Sure. So is it necessary to remember these names?
Which names?
These Herodotus and Maximus.
Well, is there any need to remember Einstein? Or you want to only remember general theory of relativity?
We don't try to remember. Yes, we know that.
Yes. But so the point is that if you come across the second time, you will see the need to remember it. If you come across the third time, then you'll think, oh, I must remember it. And the fourth time, you don't have to remember it. It will come to you automatically. So the issue is that maybe it is the first time that you heard these names, which is unfortunate actually. That's one of the reasons why we have introduced this course on history of science for CBS. It's normally not done in any undergraduate courses on science. So of course there are many other things that we need to introduce. There's no space for everything, but at least we need to take stock of some of the most important things. I mean, all of you possibly certain things got into your textbook, at least as a name. If I say Pythagoras theorem, I mean, you know what it is. But lot of people do not even know that Pythagoras theorem is given that name because there was a person called Pythagoras. That may not be known. Do you know that there was a person called Pythagoras?
Yes,
so you know about it. So do you know anything more about Pythagoras?
Yes, he was a student of Anaximenes or Ptolemy or something.
Uh-huh.
And just that name.
And for example, Pythagoras theorem was noted by Ptolemy.
Pardon?
Before Pythagoras, it was already.
Yeah, before Pythagoras, you already heard that before Pythagoras, Pythagoras theorem was already invented by someone else. I mean the same theorem, I mean not the Pythagoras theorem. Any other things you heard about? I asked you last time to take some time to look at the panel. Did any of you look at the panel last time? Yes or no? So did you look at some stuff on Pythagoras there?
Yes, sir.
What do you remember?
Square numbers.
And how are they related to anything that we are doing here? How did he relate those numbers to reality? Did you try to see any such relationships? Anyway, so what I will do is, after the break, I will flash those slides and then have a small discussion before we start the next second part of the class. Right now what I will do is, I will go ahead and discuss about one of the important turning points in the history, you can say, of not only science but in terms of even philosophy. This person's name also you must have heard number of times. The person's name is Socrates.
What? Socrates.
Socrates. Now, Socrates was a strange character. He used to roam around on the streets of Greece, and as a mostly as a youth, used to talk mostly to the youth in the city. They have these townships, and they have these things called gymnasia. You know, the kind of a kind of a place where, you know, the youth assembles every day. And they display their abilities, like suppose if they know some martial art, or you know, somebody goes and challenges, you know, can anybody beat me in archery, or can anybody beat me in some other thing. And then Socrates is to go and say that, can anybody beat me in argument. So he used to argue with people, with youth. He made that art very popular. He used to always move with lot of youth around, and used to argue with them and beat everybody in arguments. So he created a kind of Olympiads, you know, because that was a place where the Olympics began. So it was almost around the same time, you know, that was a culture. So they always had a kind of a adda, you know, where everybody assembles, and there people used to challenge and demonstrate their skills. And those skills can be a martial arts skills, they could be knowledge skills, they could be whatever skills that people have. They used to assemble there and then used to have that kind of competitions. Have you read this comic series? Which is that comic series? You said you haven't read it. Can you guess which comic strip I am talking about? Asterix. No? Asterix? What should I do with them? Come on, you haven't heard the name Asterix comics? You haven't? I mean, I'm really thinking that I should ask you to just go fetch an Asterix comics book and start reading it. Do read. Do read. It's fun, okay, and you will also visit those places where people have this kind of duels on the open in the street. You get some examples of that kind. Of course, it's a very funny caricature of the whole period, and you will get an idea about, you know, what kind of things were happening at that time. Of course, that was much later period, but then you will get some kind of a historic feeling about the thing. So do read Asterix. It's highly recommended for this class. Well, if you don't find any history of science, don't accuse me, but you must read that script. Very important. And it's a very anyway, so the reason why I'm talking about it is because in those times, you know, Socrates used to defeat every argument, and the process, he used to find problems with almost everything out there. Means it could be Thales' theories, it could be Pythagoras' theories, it could be just about any theory that he heard about, and he used to argue against all of them, saying that how can he believe any of these things? What is the validity of believing all these things? I mean, this guy says something and this guy says something else and this guy says something else, and I have heard 6 and 7 theories about the whole world. I mean, how do I know that the world is actually what? On what basis can I actually ever believe what you are saying is right? And that actually led to an art, and there is a people are called Sophism, and the people are called Sophists. Sophism is essentially this street rejection of just any great idea that has ever been invented so far. No, that is something different.
It means there is, on the street there is an argument or some topic.
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, all that I'm saying is that sophism is about arguing against almost everything. So people have developed a kind of a thing. In fact, that's why there is always some kind of a criticism about philosophers, saying that, hey, look, that guy is a philosopher. Whatever you say, he will find a problem with you. The philosophers are generally very critical. You know, whatever you say, philosophers will always find a place where, you know, they will put some spanner there. You know, they'll put some, they'll identify some problem with what you said. They'll always criticize, and that's generally what is also called the art of sophism. It's basically it's essentially a critical culture, a culture that is, and that's also one of the reasons why Socrates is very famous for. Socrates has introduced in human nature a very interesting habit of being critical. So that's the one of the interesting things. And what you should actually do, apart from reading Asterix, you should read Plato's dialogues. Plato has written a lot of dialogues. We'll come to Plato a little later. Why? Because I know whatever about Socrates or whatever, because the access was mostly from what Plato wrote about Socrates and what Aristotle wrote about Socrates. Because I haven't read what, because Socrates never wrote anything. And one of those sophists was Plato. Along with Plato, Socrates was also one of the, you can say, a student of Socrates. I mean, of course, Socrates doesn't have a school such that, you know, there is one guru and there is one shishya. There was no such thing. So essentially here, student would mean that whenever Socrates called to assemble at the Adda, you know, Plato always went there to hear to him, because he was very keen to listen to what Socrates says. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is, Socrates asked this question, how do I know? If Heraclitus is saying something, or if Parmenides is saying something, or Juno is saying something else, how do I know what you're saying is true? How do you know what you're saying is true? So he questioned those things, and nobody had very clear answers. Why? Because of one reason. All these theories that these people are talking about are as mythical as mythology. Because some, like Parmenides says, everything is one. Heraclitus says everything is in flux. Unless you prove that these things are actually held to be there, then how do you actually assess anything? I'm not saying that Socrates gave any solution to this. But in the process, Socrates had at least one most important, in my opinion, an earth-shaking idea. And what is that? And that is what is called discovery of universes. Universals and particulars. There are several names by which you can call them. Don't worry, they will stand out on their own when we are discussing. I'm not wiping the board. So you have universals and particulars. They can be also called types and tokens. Why is this such an important idea? To understand that, you have to think about the way how they thought. When people spoke any language, or they thought about some theories, they described the world around, they just did it. You know, just do it kind of attitude. They just do it. They haven't thought about what they're doing. So this is a interesting rupture in the history of knowledge that happens in the hands of Socrates. because of this critical attitude, you know, he created a kind of a moment where it became now possible for you not only do but think about what you're doing. Because criticism requires you to reflect, you know, look at yourself in the mirror. And that is what we call meta, about something. Something like, you know, you do physics, but if you do metaphysics, what you're doing is you are looking at what you're doing. You're trying to reflect on what you're doing. And that, for example, happened at least once very recently. That was a time when Niels Bohr, Bohm, Schrodinger, Dirac, you know, all these people used to discuss, Einstein, they all discussed on what they're doing. And during that period, almost every physicist has become a philosopher. And if you read any of the debates at that point, you actually see that is another rupture in the history of ideas, when everybody started reflecting on what are we doing with what we're doing. Somebody said, well, let's do it. That's one pragmatic attitude a lot of quantum physicists took. Quantum physics works, let's do it. But some people said, okay, let's do it, fine, we'll do it, but then let's also look at what we're doing. This is called interpretation problems, the foundational problems of quantum mechanics. A similar kind of thing happened in the past. That was a time when so many ideas have come. We have seen the ideas of Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, Heraclitus, Parmenides, Pythagoras, and so on. And that was a time when Socrates started this critical discussion around it. Let's halt and think about what we're doing. And it was at that period that he introduced a kind of a break. So to speak, metaphorically, what happened was something like this. So the world till that point was like this. Like a single flat slab. And in this kind of a single flat slab, this guy has separated it, you know, into two slabs like this. So to speak, he divided the reality into two. Socrates divided the reality into two. He said that there are universals and there are particulars. Before this, people have divided reality into so many other ways, like appearance and reality, form and substance. Like, people have used other themes also to work out. But they haven't become as important as this one. Because this has sort of revolutionized the way how people would think after that. You will see the consequences of it as we are slowly unfolding the later parts of what is happening in the history of ideas. What do we mean by this? Till that point, people looked at only one thing. The experience, the world, the reality, as all part and parcel of one single thing. They haven't looked at the possibility that they're actually talking about two kinds of things. Why are there two kinds of things? Let us look at the properties of it. If you look at the properties of these two things, then you will kind of get an idea. What kind of properties types have which are so different from tokens? The following things. Suppose I give you a book. Okay? Give me another copy of it. What will you do? We will just go to a photocopy machine and take another copy and give it. Right? Suppose I give you an apple and ask you to make two copies of it. Or a banana if you like. Or I give you 500 notes and say, make two copies of it. You see what I'm talking about? there are two kinds of things in this world, copyable things and non-copyable things. What is copyable? Books are copyable. You can still call a copy of a book still a book. So, in fact, there was an interesting thing. I would give you another quotation. This is from George Bernard Shaw. I'm not very good in my memory, but what he said is something like this. If I have two apples, I give it to you and you, I have none left. Right? Because I have only two apples, I have given it to two of you. If I have two ideas, I have given it to you and you and you and you and you and you. Each of us have two each. I haven't lost any by giving you those two. What does it mean? It means that there are certain things in this world which do not replenish even after something goes there. So imagine that I as a teacher come to the class with five ideas for each class. Okay, let's say there are 20 students, and then I give five ideas. I mean, assuming that I am the best teacher in the world and I managed to communicate with every one of you successfully, then how many ideas have been copied to each of your minds, so to speak? So I give five to each of you.
Five.
And I still have those five, right? My five has not disappeared. So if I distribute water like that, if I distribute anything like that, anything material, that's not possible. A token is not copyable. Anything individual, anything particular is not copyable. But something like a type is copyable. So he said there is something like a cow. I mean, I don't know whether Socrates actually talked about cow. I'm just talking about a cow because I'm an Indian. I mean, because Indian philosophers always use the word cow, a pot, and things like, okay, let's talk about a pot. So I have a pot. But you also have a pot in your house. We call that one as also a pot, this one also a pot. It occurred to Socrates that the form of these two objects, form, F-O-R-M, form, the form of these two objects is copyable. But the substance is not. Substance will always be realized and reified in the world, always as a token or a particular or an individual. And that is a substantive character of that. There is a substantive character of the particular, but universals don't have that kind of substantive character. And this was like a big debate in the streets, and it created lot of hala around that point. Any of you heard the name Zeno's paradox? Okay, so I'll give an assignment so that you read a little more about it. So the assignment is, what is Zeno's paradox? Z-E-N-O. So type Zeno on a search engine, you'll go to Zeno's paradox anyway. Unless there is a company by that name. Interesting thing is that Zeno was another sophist. Okay? And Zeno is more close to Parmenides. You know, there is always companies, like when you have friends, Zeno is more friendly to Parmenides. Parmenides was Zeno's teacher. But then when it came to talking and discussing, okay, Zeno was also one of the sophists, Parmenides was also there, everybody was there. So they're all debating about those things. And then Zeno introduced a large number of paradoxes which come just because of this division between types and tokens. So some of the paradoxes that Zeno created were created because of this perplexing character of this division that has been made by Socrates. Now, what is the importance of this particular relation? We'll see a little later, and we'll see that this relation actually ends up as one of the cementing ideas of science, without which neither mathematics, nor logic, nor philosophy, nor science, nothing is possible. But it is, of course, like taken for granted, like we always use it every day in our natural parlance. The most common way in which this particular relationship is used in our regular life is in the form of example. Like, suppose if I say something like cat, give me an example of a cat, then you say, okay, Garfield is a cat. Have you read Garfield? Oh, good, at least you read some comics. So Garfield is a kind of instance. So something like that. So, or maybe my pet dog is a dog. So when you are saying that, you are talking about an example. So who is an animal? Nagarjuna is an animal. Okay, which means that you are actually giving that example. Okay, so there exists an animal. That means, so the example that you are giving is usually considered a particular, a token, an individual. Sometimes you may also give examples of other things which are not as things, because the natural language is quite ambiguous. But that's how we use these terms, types, tokens, universals and particulars. And the other synonymous ideas that you will find in the literature for types is idea. And the other name that you also see is form. And one more thing that is used nowadays more widely is concept. So that's how the concept came into being. And so the credit goes to the discussions that Socrates had with his colleagues. But at that time, this particular discussion did not stop, mostly because of the characteristic features that people started engaging themselves with. So they started talking about one of the kind of things that Homi Bhabha Center is always worried about, that is teaching. So they started discussing these issues of how do you teach another person. And this problem was also discussed by those people at that time. Now, what do you mean by teach? They started discussing. And then they started also postulating some of these problems, such as, do we have knowledge when we are born? Or the knowledge comes from experience. So these are some of the discussions that are there. And there is one important dialogue of Plato, wherein they have discussed what is called a cave boy's problem. There was a boy in the cave. Is it possible, and that boy in the cave has never seen anything outside in the world. Okay. All that he has is some kind of a shades that he can see, because he has some kind of, let us say, a small hole. You know, when somebody walks by that hole, you know, he'll see some shade in his cave. He has never gone out of the cave. He has some access. Would that person ever be able to, let us say, understand any mathematical concepts like addition, subtraction, or what a triangle is, what a parallel line is, what a line is, and things like that. So in that dialogue that ensues, of course it was written by Plato, so we don't know exactly whether that was a real dialogue that ever took place, but then the upshot of the dialogue is actually to show that anyone, any human being can, given some kind of interrogation, that is given some questioning, if you start questioning yourself and start seeking answers and then again question, again seek answers, in the process you will be able to understand that look here, that guy is actually recollecting as if he forgot what knowledge was. He starts recollecting one after the other, and logically over a period of time he will be able to define what a circle is, define what a triangle is, define what is addition, define what is subtraction on his own without directly giving him the definitions. By that the dialogue, because you know this is what is called dialectics of Plato, so he wrote it in as a dialogue style, and there is a series of questions that he asks, and then finally he proves that even a cave boy who has never seen anything outside in the world will be able to recollect the knowledge. So that is the time when Plato gave his famous theory that universals are always there in your mind. So what mind consists of is always the universals, and then the experience will help you to recollect what you forgot, so to speak. So experience is essentially a kind of a means. Experience is a means of obtaining or recollecting what was already in there. So this introduced a kind of a debate again, because Plato had a very famous student. Do you know who was the most famous student of Plato? Aristotle. And Aristotle did not agree with Plato. He said it's just the other way around. He said experience is not the means for understanding universals or the concepts. He said types are the means for understanding the experience. Just put it the other way around. And the war continues even till today. So even today you have the same schools of thought. So there are some people who are called Platonists, and some people who are called empiricists or Aristotelians. What?
Aristotle.
Aristotle, in context to the types and tokens, what he says something like this, that it is not the case that experience becomes a means for knowledge. He says the other way around. He says that if you don't have experience, you will not be able to get the universals. So the process is not recollecting, but of induction. He says that if you have experience, you will be able to abstract from the, so what do you call it, abstraction. So this is not recollection. Recollection assumes that you already have it. Now you are just taking it out from your mind. Whereas abstraction says something like this. So you have seen a large number of crows around, and you have seen that all the crows are black, and therefore you say all crows are black. So that's a kind of an abstraction, that's a kind of a generalization that you do. So in the process you find out, you know, like what is it to be a crow, and what is it to be a black. So black, the universal black and the universal crow are sort of produced out of this kind of association. And he says that's an abstraction. So that is the kind of view that Aristotle, and Aristotle's view is famously called as empiricist kind of view. Empiricism would mean that you believe that experience is the means of reaching the knowledge. And of course what they mean by knowledge is also quite different. One of the most important things that we need to know about Socrates at this point, and also Plato in a sense, is that Plato said that what people can have in a normal discussion is only opinions. So people can have opinions, but opinion is not knowledge, he says. And then what is the distinction between knowledge and opinion? The difference is that if you have knowledge, and that knowledge will not change. It's an unchanging knowledge. So how do you get that kind of knowledge? That kind of knowledge is obtained by a method called definition. All of us know what is definition because we use it every time. But one of the interesting features is that it was Plato who discovered what is definition in the context of bringing out a distinction between what people can know, what kind of knowledge is there. He says there are two kinds of knowledge. What are the two kinds of knowledge? One is a knowledge called general opinion, that is a folklore. And there is another kind of knowledge, and that knowledge that comes from definitions. So knowledge that is coming from definitions would be something like this. Suppose if I have to say something like anything, let us say you want to say what is an animal, or what would you say, or what is a matter, how do you define what matter is? Yeah, so there are two things that you have used in that process. What are this?
Mass
and space. So to define matter, you have used mass and space as the two other concepts. So now what Plato used to say, Plato said that these two concepts are used to create this equality of what this matter is. This is called definition. So in a kind of a definition, when you rule the left hand side and the right hand side, you will have what is called equality. So this is a kind of model. So if you want to write a definition, you will always have this kind of problem. Suppose if I say a simple thing like rat is an animal, is it a definition? Is it a definition? No. That's not a definition. Then what is this? Rat is animal means the following. In actual terms, in which that is the meaning of rat is an animal. Can you interpret that?
Yes.
What is the meaning of that? There is a set, the class of all animals, and there is a class of other animals called rats. So that is the meaning of the rat is animal. These are what Plato calls them superclass and subclass, a supertype and subtype. Okay, now this is another interesting thing about this. So types and tokens, or universals and particulars, was discovered by or invented by Socrates. And his student Plato discussed this another important relationship. And what is this?
Call it
class, subclass. You can also call it by so many other names. You can also call it as type, subtype, kind of relation. Suppose if I say something like this. The rat is an animal. I am talking about this specific rat. Which rat? The Jerry. Okay, I am talking about Jerry. I am not talking about anything else. So Jerry is an animal. So you are saying Jerry is an animal. And what is that relationship? Rat is animal is type, subtype. Now I am saying Jerry is an animal. So Jerry is a particular, and animal is the species. So this way, you can try, look at all the languages that you utter, Look at anything that you do in science, non-science, literature, any kind of language, whatever, you can paraphrase everything that you are doing in terms of these two relationships. It is claimed that you don't need any other relationship other than these two. Of course, you need one more important thing. Can you guess what is that? And that is implicit. That is implicit in stating this. When I say Jerry is animal, you are also implicitly saying that Jerry is not a plant, is not a stone. What does that mean? That means that Jerry is not a member of the class stone. Jerry is not a member of the class trees. So every assertion that you make, okay, partitions the world, so to speak. And that is how you can convey some information. Now, you can't convey any information without partitioning. So if we don't do any classing or subclassing, and if you don't divide the world around, you will not be able to convey anything. So you will be able to convey something only if the other person has exactly understood the way how you have partitioned yourself in your mind. So this transfer of knowledge actually happens only when both of us are actually partitioning the world in the same way. That's how the meaning gets to the other person. So this is also another important thing, and this of course is called negation. Given negation and given these relationships, it is claimed that you don't need anything else. And this was a very important kind of a revelation during that period. And when people are started doing this kind of analysis, at least in the Greek context, came out what is called grammar of a language. So the first beginnings of grammar for the Greek language was invented at that time. And that was also been mostly done by Parmenides and Zeno. So Zeno's discussions that has gone along with everything, that was a kind of a context where the initial structure of grammar has come out. Now, what do you need for grammar to understand the structure of a language that people speak? One of the most important distinctions that you have to make is that what is the subject and what is the predicate of a statement. So what is the subject and the predicate of the statements that we wrote there as examples? Rat is animal. Rat is the subject, and animal is the predicate.
So what is negation?
What is negation? Not. To say that something is not this. Suppose when you are saying that something is an animal, you are implicitly saying that it is not this thing. So suppose I have to say, I utter a proposition that Jerry is an animal. Is it true? Well, at least the language that we speak says that it is true. Suppose if I say Jerry is not a plant, is it true? It can be. How? But at least, you know, since you already know that it is an animal. Okay, if I am saying that Jerry is not a plant, should be true. If I say that Jerry is not a stone, that will also be true, right? So in that sense, it's already contained in that kind of thing. So that means it's actually possible for you to derive a large number of statements which are also true. I mean, they may not be of any use to you, but then you cannot say that what is inferred from what you have stated is false. It will not be invalid to say that, because that is already contained in the statement that was given to you. So this is a this is the kind of interesting exercise that was happening around this period. So they started looking at the structure of the language and trying to look at it in terms of types and tokens, and also as species and subspecies. And it was at that time that Plato introduced a very important idea, and that is considered of a very great importance to science, and that is the idea that all concepts can be shown to be coming out from some one single concept. And he introduced a notion of what is called hierarchy. Have you heard the term hierarchy before?
Yes.
What is hierarchical? Can you give an example? Classification is a hierarchy. Can you give any other examples of hierarchy?
Ecological
hierarchy. Right? And you can see the hierarchy is implicit in that diagram that we drew there. Like hierarchy can also be drawn like this. You can also draw hierarchy like this. Right? And I can divide this into again two or maybe three. And again I can divide each of them like this. So this essentially, you know, gives rise to what is called a hierarchical tree. So this is a follow-up of Platonic idea. And that's why this kind of trees are called Platonic in nature, or hierarchical in nature as such. So this particular concept, whatever that concept be, okay, is called summum bonum, the sum of all, the thing that includes everything else, from which everything else can be said to be following from. So this was a kind of a, it has become kind of a pursuit, you know, to understand this. But remember one important thing, that all these things in this kind of a tree, where is a particular? Actually speaking, particulars are not part of this tree, because the last item here is not a particular. You may at the most call it the species. That is, the smallest class that you want to end up with at the end can only be called a species. You cannot call it. So what is the particular? Particulars are always there as members of any of these classes. Why? I'll tell you the reason why. Suppose if there is a subspecies here, and there are these members of this. Are these members of this class?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
They are members of this class.
Yes.
Are these member of this class?
Yes.
No.
Why? Because there is a partition.
Partition.
Are they a member of this class?
Yes.
This is all that you need to do deduction. So the whole deductive logic is based on this inference that is possible. So once you make an assertion, you'll be able to deduce what follows from it. So all that you need, therefore, is that you need a general statement. A general statement is usually an association of that kind, that a rat is an animal, or you can say Socrates is mortal. You heard about this statement, Socrates is mortal? Okay, there is a famous a form of sentences, and the sentences go like this. It's very commonly used in logic, if you have ever done logic. So the first statement is, all men are mortal. All men are mortal. Okay? The second statement says, Socrates is a man. What follows from it?
Socrates
is mortal. Now, how do you get that? You get that from this tree itself. So all that you have to do is just draw the tree, and just drawing this tree is enough for you to understand how the meaning is flowing and how the deduction happens, how the inference can happen. And as you can see, inference is everywhere. You have possibly done proofs in mathematics, geometry particularly, Euclidean geometry, you have done proofs. You have done proofs in almost all kinds of mathematical disciplines. You do proofs all the time, you do arguments in science, you do derivations in science, all of them are deductive in nature. All those deductions use this simple logic. So that is another upshot of the discussions that took place during that period. That's one of the most important reasons why we are studying the Greek history when we are doing the history of science. Okay, so as you could see here that in this lecture we just looked at one of the important distinctions that was made between types and tokens. And then there was distinction also made among the types. What is the distinction among the types? Subclass distinction. So distinction between the types and tokens was made by Socrates. Distinction among the types is made by Plato. And then we do not know exactly who made, but possibly by Plato, possibly by some other Greek grammatic experts in that area of, you know, like the school of Parmenides, essentially was possibly the place where the subject predicate distinction has come out, where they started writing the grammar in terms of subject predicate logic, and all this has become one of the most important things. Of course, the negation was also very famously become part of this whole discussion about the role of negation as an operation. So, like, what happens to negation? What happens if you apply negation on something? What you get out of it? Suppose if you say something is an animal, what is not an animal? Everything else, the complementary class. So they use that word, the complementary class, the rest of this. So anything other than that is actually the meaning of that. So what is animal actually is also contained in the not being an animal as well. So in that sense, the whole discussion construed, and that led to finally Aristotle, who wrote the Principles of Logic. The Principles of Logic is the first formal text in the history, at least in the context of Greek. In the context of Indian history of science, Panini's grammar was the first formal text. So Panini's grammar is also structured in the same axiomatic form, the way how Euclid, for example, wrote for geometry. So both of them have a very similar kind of characters. There is some difference though. Parini's grammar is more like algorithms, whereas the Aristotle's logic or Euclid's logic was more deductive in character. So there are some kind of, for example, you will find many number of rules in Parini's grammar. So it's rule based. So it's a rule based kind of thing. Whereas in that case, in the case of Euclidean and as well as Aristotle's logic, you will see it's all principle based. So they are given the principles. They don't have to go on writing everything else, because everything else can be derived automatically once you have given the rules of the principles of how to derive the whole things. So Aristotle, of course, later on gave the remaining part of it. He has talked about he wrote the logic in two steps. One is called the prior analytics, the other is called the posterior analytics, the two important books that he has written. So in these two books you would see the foundations of what is called the logic, as it were. So we will later on see some more developments that happen in logic, but what we'll do is we'll stop here for the first part of the lecture, and in the later part we will carry on with some of the other issues that we need to look at in the Greek context. So we'll look at some examples from the Greeks. This is which day? 28. So we have one more class on when? Fourth or third?
Fourth.
We have a class on fourth. Okay. So there is a likelihood that I may not be here for the class on 11th. So there are two things I'll try to do. One is I will try to have a guest lecture on 11th. Because I won't be able to be here on 11th. If that is not possible, then that would be a chutti for you.
Chemistry lab will be.
You can think about advancing the chemistry lab, yes. But then don't advance it right away. Wait for a while, because that will happen if I can't find a guest lecture. Okay. So we'll break and then come back. After 15 minutes?
Yes, sir. Yes.
So, what time?
12:20.
12:20.
Standard